the general offered similar advice to his colleagues on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, enjoining them to be more than military men. After meeting with Johnson on the same day, Taylor left for Cape Cod to bid farewell to former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. He had remained close to the former president's family. Soon after his arrival in Saigon on July 7th, he received a letter in which Mrs. Kennedy thanked him for demonstrating once again the devotion you always showed to Jack. She credited Taylor with making greatness possible for her husband by helping him overcome the Bay of Pigs debacle and making the second Cuba a triumph. Jacqueline Kennedy's letter evoked the memory of the crisis in civil-military relations that grew out of the Bay of Pigs incident, bringing the general to Washington and ending his 3-year retirement from military service. Taylor had a profound impact on the Kennedy administration. He had helped the president replace recalcitrant members of the Joint Chiefs with men who would prove more sensitive to domestic political concerns. He had been instrumental in appointing General Harkins in Westmoreland and had helped to shape the American effort in Vietnam. He had developed and overseen the implementation of the advisory effort, and until November 1963 had joined McNamara in praising the headway that U.S. advisors and their South Vietnamese allies had made. Perhaps Taylor's most significant legacy, however, was his shaping of the relationship between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the president that affected the decision-making on Vietnam in 1963 and 1964. Long an advocate of the centralization of responsibility in the chairmanship of the JCS, Taylor possessed the dominant military voice in connection with U.S. policy toward Vietnam. Although he had lamented divisions among the chiefs during the Eisenhower administration, he used those divisions to his advantage under President Johnson. When he found it expedient to do so, he misled the JCS, the press, and the National Security Council. He deliberately relegated his fellow military officers to a position of little influence and assisted McNamara in suppressing JCS objections to the concept of graduated pressure, reinforcing the secretary's confidence in his ability to develop strategic options for Vietnam independent of JCS advice. Ever loyal to the president and sensing Johnson's election year desire for unity and consensus, Taylor shielded him from the views of his less politically sensitive colleagues while telling the chiefs that their recommendations had been given full consideration. To keep the chiefs from expressing dissenting views, he helped to craft a relationship based on distrust and deceit, in which the president obscured the finality of decisions and made false promises that the JCS conception of the war might one day be realized. Neither the insidious relationship between the leading civilian and military officials in the Johnson administration, nor the planning efforts in the spring of 1964, predestined the Johnson administration to escalate American military involvement in Vietnam. Nonetheless, they firmly established in the minds of key decision makers a flawed strategy for fighting what seemed to them a war without precedent. Chapter 6. Across the Threshold, July to August, 1964. With the opportunity to observe the problems of a president at closer range, I have come to understand the importance of an intimate, easy relationship born of friendship and mutual regard between the president and the chiefs. It is particularly important in the case of the chairman. The chairman should be a true believer in the foreign policy and military strategy of the administration which he serves. Maxwell Taylor, 1972. Like the Diem coup in November 1963, the American response to reported attacks on U.S. Navy destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin in early August 1964 marked a turning point in the Vietnam War. After a first attack on American destroyers, to which the peace candidate, Lyndon Johnson, chose not to retaliate, the president ordered airstrikes on North Vietnam in response to confused reports surrounding an alleged attack that probably did not occur. Johnson retaliated with sharply limited airstrikes against North Vietnam based on McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure. The American response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident solidified in practice McNamara's strategic concept. It became clear as well that graduated pressure was ideally suited to the president's determination to base his Vietnam policy on domestic political needs. Although the direct overt action against North Vietnam represented an important change in American military involvement in the war, the most profound result was a congressional resolution that, in effect, gave the president carte blanche for the escalation of the war. Johnson wanted such a resolution to protect himself from future congressional attacks on his Vietnam policy. Preoccupied with the campaign, Lyndon Johnson was determined to make only those decisions that would redound to his short-term political benefit. To enhance his chances for election, he and McNamara deceived the American people and the Congress about events and the nature of the American commitment in Vietnam. They used a questionable report of a North Vietnamese attack on American naval vessels to justify the president's policy to the electorate and to defuse Republican senator and presidential candidate Barry Goldwater's charges that Lyndon Johnson was irresolute and soft in the foreign policy arena. In many respects, the American response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident seems, in retrospect, a rehearsal for Lyndon Johnson's escalation of the war after he defeated Goldwater in the presidential election. When it turned out to his benefit, the president appeared restrained and measured in his approach. When pressure to take military action grew, he responded with apparent determination and resolve. All his actions, however, betrayed his penchant for taking actions disconnected from military realities and without full appreciation of their consequences. The experience underlined what Lyndon Johnson wanted and expected from his principal military advisors. The credibility lent his policy by their uniforms rather than their opinions. How the chiefs would respond to Johnson's expectations would depend largely on the character of the man who replaced Maxwell Taylor. Based on Taylor's recommendation, Johnson appointed the Army Chief of Staff, General Earl Wheeler. Wheeler's selection continued to shift away from appointing combat commanders toward choosing officers more experienced in staff work and managing information. Wheeler lacked combat experience and was little known to the American public. The chairman of the JCS who preceded him had distinguished themselves in battle during World War II and the Korean War. Wheeler had spent most of World War II engaged in the important but unglamorous task of training National Guard units. He served in Europe during the last 5 months of the war as a division chief of staff. Accordingly, Wheeler's most notable qualities were those of a skilled staff officer. He was a master administrator who gave lucid, well-organized briefings. Because of his aptitude for staff work, Wheeler spent the preponderance of his career in Washington, D.C. In the late 1950s, Army Chief of Staff Taylor entrusted him with the Army's strategic planning. Taylor soon promoted Wheeler to be his operations deputy, and the two worked together to change Eisenhower's defense policies. In 1958, Wheeler headed a joint committee charged with improving inter-service planning and decision-making. After serving 2 years as deputy commander-in-chief of the European Command, he returned to Washington as the director of the joint staff. The outcome of the 1960 presidential election gave Wheeler's career a boost. He gave weekly briefings on world military developments to presidential candidate John F. Kennedy. Kennedy shared the Army's dissatisfaction with Eisenhower's New Look defense policies and was impressed with Wheeler's bearing and eloquence. Although he had never been an athlete, the handsome Wheeler was tall and fit. His manner was gentlemanly and affable. Kennedy was drawn instinctively to men who, like himself, were sharp-witted and prepossessing in appearance. When Kennedy announced Taylor's appointment to the chairmanship of the JCS in August 1962, Taylor recommended his old operations deputy as the Army Chief of Staff. The Washington Post commented that Wheeler might be called the beau ideal of a modern U.S. military commander. He fits like a glove the exacting specifications laid down by President Kennedy and Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara. Wheeler, a former math instructor at West Point, established a good relationship with the analytical-minded Secretary of Defense. McNamara, furthermore, wanted team players, not opinionated, irascible military heroes. And, as a new man, Wheeler fit the bill. As Army Chief of Staff, he worked amicably with the Whiz Kids and implemented McNamara's reforms without complaint. He supported the Defense Secretary when he needed it most, during congressional hearings on the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and Pentagon budget reforms. Wheeler rebutted, point by point, before the Congress, LeMay's concerns about proposed limitations on nuclear testing, and told the Senate Appropriations Committee that McNamara's budgetary methods represented a great step forward. Unlike a high-ranking officer coming to Washington for the first time, Chairman Wheeler was sensitive to and familiar with the political machinations of the Pentagon, the White House, and Capitol Hill. For example, before General Westmoreland departed for his assignment to Vietnam, Wheeler told the MACV commander designate to coordinate his actions very closely with the embassy in Saigon and to avoid statements or actions potentially embarrassing to the Johnson administration. Wheeler warned Westmoreland that the war could be lost in Washington if Congress loses faith. Wheeler's sensitivity to the politics of executive-legislative relations made him an attractive choice for Lyndon Johnson. In time, Wheeler developed a close association with the president. Johnson would count on Buzz, his actual nickname was Bus, but Wheeler chose not to correct the president, as one of his 10 best friends in Washington. When asked about Wheeler's relationship with the president, Lieutenant General Andrew Goodpaster recalled that Johnson had a way of befriending people and then using that friendship to exact acquiescence on controversial issues. Wheeler did not like direct confrontation, and he was susceptible to the president's patronage. Loyalty was the criterion Johnson and McNamara thought essential for their appointees, and they thought that they could count on Wheeler to be a team player. Wheeler's appointment was immensely unpopular with many Pentagon officers, particularly those outside the Army. Navy and Air Force officers considered his appointment a blow to their services because it again undermined the precedent of rotating the chairmanship between the services. When Taylor replaced Army General Lemnitzer, it had been the Navy's turn to hold the chairmanship. Wheeler became the third Army officer in a row to hold the position. Many officers viewed Wheeler's appointment as a continuation of Taylor's and the Army's influence over defense policy. LeMay was particularly suspicious of Wheeler and, referring to the new chairman's relationship with Taylor, called him Polly Parrot. In an obvious allusion to Wheeler's lack of combat experience, LeMay said facetiously that Wheeler had earned one of his ribbons for fighting the Battle of Fort Benning, an Army post in Georgia, where Wheeler trained the National Guard units during World War II. Marine Colonel William Corson of General Greene's staff bluntly criticized Wheeler as the Army's highest-ranking sycophant. Wheeler's lack of credibility with some officers in the Pentagon contrasted with the impressive military credentials of his predecessor, Maxwell Taylor. Wheeler also lacked the drive and energy to discharge his responsibilities to the fullest, something Taylor probably did not consider a drawback. Taylor liked to weaken any post he left to guarantee that he had no rival to undermine his influence in his new position. In October 1962, when he departed the White House as President Kennedy's military advisor, he recommended abolishing that office. Although Taylor could not modify the chief's legal responsibilities, before leaving for Vietnam, he drafted and had the president sign a letter that, in addition to his duties as the president's diplomatic representative, gave him complete control over the American military effort in South Vietnam. As you take charge of the American effort in South Vietnam, I want you to have this formal expression not only of my confidence, but my desire that you have and exercise full responsibility. Specifically, I want it clearly understood that this overall responsibility includes the whole military effort in South Vietnam and authorizes the degree of command and control that you consider appropriate. At your convenience, I should be glad to know of the arrangements which you propose for meeting the terms of this instruction, so that appropriate supporting action can be taken in the Defense Department and elsewhere as necessary. Taylor's mandate eroded traditional military prerogatives and expanded civilian responsibilities in military affairs. McGeorge Bundy highlighted the fact that the letter gave Taylor full control over everything in South Vietnam, something the military never let the ambassador have before. And now that we have a man whom the military cannot refuse, it is time to establish the principle. Taylor would work closely with General Westmoreland, whom, over the objections of his colleagues, he had installed in Vietnam 3 months earlier. Indeed, Johnson's grant of plenipotentiary powers to Taylor as ambassador, combined with the appointment of Wheeler as his replacement at the JCS, further weakened the Joint Chiefs' ability to influence military policy and planning for Vietnam. Other governmental departments and agencies quickly acknowledged Taylor's wide-ranging authority. The Deputy Director of the CIA, Lieutenant General Marshall S. Carter, wrote to Taylor, lauding him as the coach, the captain, and the quarterback of the team in Vietnam, and assuring him that the assets of the agency were at his disposal. Rusk vowed that as the principal officer in the field, Taylor's views would be of critical importance. He charged Taylor with developing a concise military evaluation for the White House as an alternative to the reporting through military channels that had presented a fragmented picture. Although Taylor enjoyed a broad mandate, the president's principal motivation in appointing him ambassador was to use Taylor's military reputation to protect his administration from charges that his Vietnam policy was soft. The president's letter had given the ambassador great confidence, and Taylor wasted no time exercising his broad license. He promised to undertake a vigorous review of all mission activities. On July 7th, the day he arrived in Saigon, he cabled that he was reorganizing operations in Saigon under direction of a U.S. mission council over which I will preside. As soon as he began working in Saigon, Taylor realized that the situation in the South was worse than he had thought when he was in Washington. On July 15th, he revised upward the estimate of Viet Cong's strength in South Vietnam to between 28 and 34,000 and reported increased Viet Cong activity in the northern provinces. He argued that, although this was not an occasion for overconcern, the growing magnitude of our problems required the intensification of the South Vietnamese and American counterinsurgency efforts. Taylor required additional American military advisors to expand the pacification effort in the countryside surrounding Saigon, known as Hop Tac, and promised that a request for supplementary military personnel would be forthcoming. His thorough reporting pleased McGeorge Bundy, who wrote to the president that there was just no comparison with what we used to get from Ambassador Lodge. 2 days later, Taylor sent a message to Rusk, detailing Westmoreland's request for about 2,000 additional people. When added to previous requests, the proposal called for an increase of 4,200 in the advisory and support force. American military personnel in Vietnam would grow from 16 to 22,000 in the next 6 to 12 months. Taylor and Westmoreland envisioned doubling the advisory effort in South Vietnamese combat units, as well as a twofold increase in the number of places where U.S. advisors served. The plan also provided more Navy advisors on South Vietnamese vessels, expanded the MACV's staff and logistics support activities, and introduced into South Vietnam an Air Force cargo squadron of 16 aircraft, one Army airplane company of 16 aircraft, and two Army helicopter companies of 50 aircraft. Taylor supported the proposal without qualification, estimating that the increases would satisfy pacification requirements for the next year. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were unable to influence President Johnson's consideration of the Taylor-Westmoreland request, in part because Taylor had a direct line to the White House, and in part because inter-service rivalry prevented them from reaching agreement on the issue in time to effect the decision. According to established procedure, General Westmoreland should have sent the request to the Joint Chiefs of Staff through the Commander-in-Chief Pacific. Although Ambassador Taylor sent a copy of the proposal to the JCS, he addressed his July 17th telegram to Rusk and McGeorge Bundy. Yet it was the chief's infighting that undercut their influence most. On July 20th, McNamara discussed with them the introduction of additional troops into South Vietnam. The chiefs could not agree on the issue and told McNamara that they wanted time to solicit from Westmoreland a detailed justification for the increase. The next day, however, McNamara met with the President, Rusk, and Bundy for their Tuesday lunch. The proposed increase in the advisory and support effort was the first item on the agenda. The President and his luncheon companions did not wait for the chief's recommendation. After lunch, Rusk informed Taylor that highest authority has approved in principle the requested increase in authorized military strength to approximately 22,000. He told Taylor to ensure that there was no intentional or accidental release of information on this subject because the President wanted to withhold public disclosure of the decision. Thus, the Joint Chiefs did not produce an assessment of the troop increase until 3 days after the President had approved it. In fact, because the Chiefs could not agree on the introduction of the Army airplane and helicopter companies, they did not respond fully to Westmoreland's request for additional Army aircraft until August 4th, 2 days after North Vietnamese patrol boats revolutionized the situation in Vietnam by firing on two American destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf. Wheeler, the newly promoted General Harold K. Johnson, who had replaced Wheeler as Army Chief of Staff, and McDonald supported the request without qualification. LeMay and Green, however, did not believe that Westmoreland's request represented a potential contribution to the war. They argued that Westmoreland had not identified the need for these units in specific operational terms. The controversy over Army aviation was the principal reason why, for 2 weeks, the chiefs were unable to render an opinion on Westmoreland's request for additional air assets. General Bruce Palmer, operations deputy to Army Chief Johnson, recalled that the debate reached bitter proportions in the summer of 1964 and often affected discussions on Vietnam. LeMay and Green questioned the need for more Army aircraft in South Vietnam because they believed that Westmoreland's request represented a surreptitious attempt to expand the Army's air arm. During one JCS session, as the chiefs were discussing their response to the proposed increase in Army aviation assets, LeMay suddenly removed his cigar from his mouth, turned toward Johnson, and challenged the Army Chief of Staff to an aerial duel, shouting, "You fly one of these damn Hueys, and I'll fly an F-105, and we'll see who survives. I'll shoot you down and scatter your pea shooter all over the goddamn ground." Johnson replied that he would be happy to learn how to fly and take you on, suggesting that they should decide on a time and place later. He then calmly enjoined his colleagues to discuss other matters at hand. The Air Force operations deputy left his seat to attempt to pacify his boss. Wheeler sought peace among his colleagues by recommending that the chiefs postpone discussion of this controversial matter without confronting a major operational issue that required speedy resolution. In fact, The chiefs never reached a consensus on Westmoreland's request. So Wheeler finally sent a split recommendation to McNamara on August 4th, 2 weeks after the president had decided the issue. The chiefs' chronic inability to transcend inter-service rivalry had, once again, rendered them irrelevant to the policymaking process. While the chiefs fought over the service's roles and missions, Taylor was establishing his primacy as a military advisor on Vietnam policy. The Office of the Secretary of Defense bypassed the JCS to solicit Taylor's advice. On July 23rd, for example, an OSD cable went directly to Saigon to request the ambassador's views on how to bolster the South Vietnamese counter-infiltration effort along the Mekong River. 3 days later, McNaughton circumvented the chiefs by sending a tentative list of military options through Forrestal to Taylor and Leonard Unger, ambassador to Laos. Under Rusk's signature, McNamara and Forrestal recommended air attacks into the Laotian panhandle to interdict and destroy facilities supporting infiltration into South Vietnam. The strikes, however, would mainly aim to boost morale in South Vietnam and quiet recent South Vietnamese calls for direct action against the North. McNaughton's plan specified the type of aircraft that would conduct the mission, the kind of armaments they would use, and the number of sorties they would fly per day. Although he predicted that some planes would probably be downed in Laos during attacks on initial targets, losses would be less than 2%. It was clear from Taylor's response that he intended to direct military planning from his post in Saigon. He argued that action against targets in the Laotian panhandle was not urgent and expressed confidence that joint contingency planning with South Vietnamese military for cross-border operations would mollify General Khan and discourage future calls for action against the North. Sensitive to President Johnson's election year concerns, he proposed an alternative to McNaughton's plan that would be more difficult to discern as an escalation of the war. The United States might avoid adverse international opinion if the Air Force conducted attacks under the pretense of armed reconnaissance, for they had been flying low-level reconnaissance missions over communist-occupied areas in Laos since May 21st. Taylor observed, "In the course of flying reconnaissance missions, there would be ample opportunity and excuse to destroy targets such as those in McNaughton's plan." He asserted that the Saigon embassy was the logical venue for planning such covert raids. On the same day that Taylor cabled the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff responded to a specific request from President Johnson to develop contingencies for military action in Vietnam. Through Secretary McNamara, Johnson ordered the JCS to consider only those military actions that would A. contribute militarily to the success of the counterinsurgency effort in the Republic of Vietnam, B. reduce the frustration and defeatism of the Republic of Vietnam leaders by undertaking punitive measures against the enemy outside the borders of the Republic of Vietnam, C. entail minimum risk of escalatory measures by the enemy, and D. require minimum U.S. participation in a combat role. The chiefs replied that, of the many courses of action examined, only three fall within the established parameters. These included airstrikes against infiltration routes through Laos into South Vietnam, ground operations into Laos against the communist infiltration effort, and selected airstrikes using non-U.S. unmarked aircraft against military targets in North Vietnam. Although these limited actions could prove militarily and psychologically beneficial to the war effort in South Vietnam, they would not significantly affect communist support of Viet Cong operations in South Vietnam and might have counterproductive results in Laos. McNamara and Johnson had solicited the Joint Chiefs' opinion in such a way as to force them to provide the advice that the president and his advisors wanted to hear. Two of the four objectives enumerated to guide the chief's development of military options, C, minimum risk of escalation by the enemy, and D, minimum U.S. participation in combat, were negative ones. The chiefs could minimize the risk of escalation and limit the involvement of U.S. forces only by restricting the application of military power. By stipulating these negative aims, Johnson was able to interpret the JCS memorandum as an endorsement of the sharply limited military actions that the Joint Chiefs had hitherto resisted. Michael Forrestal, now the Secretary of State's Special Assistant for Vietnam, reported that the JCS memo represented a very significant step forward, since it gives the Chiefs tentative approval to the very kinds of limited actions which we may want to use in the event Hanoi steps things up. Wheeler's weakness, Taylor's circumvention of the JCS, the Chiefs' infighting, McNamara's restrictions on the military options that the JCS could consider, and the exclusiveness of the Tuesday lunches removed the Chiefs entirely from policy deliberations on Vietnam. Still, Johnson's exclusion of the Chiefs had not gone unnoticed. Senator Goldwater charged Johnson with ignoring his military advisors. Much of the discussion during the July 14th luncheon, at which the president approved Taylor's and Westmoreland's requests, centered on answering Republican charges that the Johnson administration had weakened the bonds of confidence between civilian leaders and the nation's top military professionals, and bypassed seasoned military judgment in vital national security issues. McNamara responded that the bonds of confidence and understanding between this administration's top civilian leaders and the nation's top military leaders has never been stronger. He trumpeted the achievements of the XCOM during the Cuban Missile Crisis and used quotations from former JCS chairman Lemnitzer and Taylor to support his characterization of civil-military relations as harmonious. They were anything but harmonious. Because Johnson was combining discussions of his campaign strategy with Vietnam policy deliberations, he felt he should not include the chiefs, whose interests and priorities focused on national security issues, in the policy discussions. Johnson, however, did not conceive of Vietnam as primarily a national security issue. Rather, he saw it mainly as the issue that could cost him the election. His principal objective remained keeping Vietnam out of the campaign. Obviously, the chiefs did not conceive of Vietnam in that way, and they were, therefore, useless and perhaps even threatening to Johnson's Vietnam policy deliberations. Although the president was preoccupied with the domestic political aspects of Vietnam, the American people persisted in regarding it as a foreign policy issue. Johnson's advisors, therefore, had to justify Vietnam policy decisions made solely on the basis of electoral concerns as having been made in response to the situation and actual American national security interests in Vietnam. Johnson's short-term political interests contradicted long-term planning for an escalation of the war. The president's advisors worried that their election year rhetoric might make bombing North Vietnam so unattractive to the American people that after the election, they would be unable to implement those plans. William Bundy and Forrestal, who recognized the inconsistency between the administration's stated and actual intentions, suggested how Democratic speakers might talk around the conflicting priorities of getting their president elected and preserving their freedom of action in Vietnam. Speeches were to emphasize that the primary problem existed within the borders of South Vietnam, but state that the administration would spare no effort in assisting its Southeast Asian allies. Speakers might downplay the seriousness of the situation in Vietnam by highlighting the strengths of the South Vietnamese army, which possessed superior firepower and mobility. They should emphasize the unique qualities of Ambassador Taylor to create the impression that there existed a strong possibility that the situation in South Vietnam would improve substantially. Speeches, in other words, misrepresented the actual situation in Vietnam to justify the president's reluctance to take military action before the election, while preserving his options to escalate the war after November. Bundy and Forrestal suggested that speakers couple reassurances that the administration was for peace with the qualification that future options had not been ruled out. The memo suggested raising the specter of higher American casualties to defend the president's prudent course, but advised that speakers temper their policy defense with the pledge that preventing communist domination of South Vietnam is of the highest importance to U.S. national security. Democratic candidates and supporters were to remind the electorate that if South Vietnam fell, so too would Burma and India to the west and the Philippines to the east. Speakers were to baffle the electorate with ambiguity and subtle qualification. Bundy and Forrestal concluded with a tribute to Lyndon Johnson's wisdom and patience. They recommended touting the administration's current policy as the most effective way to resolve the conflict without resort to wider action and with the least possible loss of life, either by Americans or Vietnamese. Whereas Johnson's closest civilian advisors tried to protect his campaign image as a peacemaker, his military advisors were not privy to the election strategy. Wheeler had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs for approximately 2 weeks when, during a background briefing to Pentagon reporters, someone asked him whether additional American soldiers would be going to Vietnam. He responded that additional advisors would soon embark for Southeast Asia. The July 15th editions of major newspapers gave the story front-page coverage. Although the press remained unaware of the extent of the advisory increase, the New York Times announced that the withdrawals that were set in motion last Christmas, when 1,000 of 16,500 men were withdrawn, have been reversed. The general's forthrightness caused considerable consternation among McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, and President Johnson. McNamara offered the excuse that Wheeler was caught off guard and was unable to sidestep the question. Bundy was less sympathetic and expressed disbelief that Wheeler did not hedge long enough to give the White House staff a crack at it. Wheeler was expected not only to support the administration's policy, but to keep aspects of it concealed from the American public to bolster Johnson's election bid. Wheeler's inadvertent revelation of the advisory increase in South Vietnam did not convince the administration to announce the full extent of the reinforcement. McGeorge Bundy reassured the president that the increase was consistent with our policy of pacification in the South and was not the sort of thing that we would gain much from by announcing at the White House. He lamented the missed opportunity to make an earlier statement that would have misled the press and perhaps preempted the Wheeler disclosure. He would have told reporters that these small numbers of people are connected with the critical provinces and other elements of our May and June decisions. The Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs set out to control the potentially damaging effects of Wheeler's statement. He cabled Barry Zorthian, Taylor's counselor for public affairs, to suggest that he deceived the press by announcing that the 16,000 advisors in Saigon already included the increase that Wheeler had divulged. On July 27th, Zorthian, who would later head the Saigon embassy's effort to convince correspondents that the war was being won, responded that the scheme was impractical because the announcement of additional advisors was so recent that the new personnel could not have arrived by now. Zorthian recommended that the embassy stick to the actual facts to save confusion and embarrassment in the numbers game in the future. On July 22nd, press reports from Saigon divulged further the degree to which Johnson was silently deepening American involvement in the Vietnam War. South Vietnamese Air Commodore Nguyen Cao Ky, perhaps hoping to pressure the American government into further actions against North Vietnam, announced to reporters that his planes had been dropping sabotage teams over the North. His remarks were the first official statement that South Vietnam was conducting military operations directly against North Vietnam. In response to news stories covering Ky's revelation, the president asked McGeorge Bundy for an update on the airdrops. On July 24th, Bundy informed Johnson that there had been a total of 8 drops since April 1964 as part of our overall covert plan 34 Alpha. He reported that the operations had been only moderately successful and the casualty rates high. The airdrops had, in fact, been an abysmal failure. South Vietnamese soldiers regarded the covert operations as suicide missions. Fearful paratroopers failed to report for duty, and their officers often arrived in drunken stupors so they would be declared unfit for the operation. Those who did parachute into North Vietnam were often detected by the enemy and never heard from again. Despite the failure of early 34 Alpha operations, McNamara remained an enthusiastic advocate of the program. The incursions provided him with an opportunity to test his statistical analysis techniques for tracking and controlling military operations. McNamara believed that covert operations were an ideal method for applying pressure on North Vietnam while minimizing the risk of escalating the war. The object of the covert operations, maximum pressure with minimum risk, was a military translation of the economist's cost-benefits ratio. Above all, covert operations appealed to McNamara because they allowed him to apply carefully measured pressure against North Vietnam without jeopardizing the president's campaign. Eager to get on with the operations, McNamara had grown impatient with delays in the Navy's portion of the 34 Alpha program, seaborne strikes and raids against North Vietnamese naval and port facilities along the coast. Maritime operations, or MAROPS, involved teams of South Vietnamese sailors and saboteurs using small, high-speed motorboats commanded and crewed by U.S. Navy SEALs. Equipped with 40-millimeter cannons or 81-millimeter mortars, the boats either shelled their objectives or landed frogmen to plant explosives. After hitting their targets, the teams withdrew to their base in Da Nang, South Vietnam. Senior naval officers had raised doubts about the operations. In May, Admiral Sharp noted that he had been watching this program closely and had seen some of his early reservations become a reality. He warned that North Vietnamese defenses against maritime attacks may be more extensive and effective than originally assessed. McNamara remained undaunted, however, and Taylor and Wheeler supported him. After forcing American-built patrol boats on the advisory team, who believed that the craft were ill-suited for these kind of coastal strikes, McNamara pressed SINCPAC to begin the operations. By the end of May, Americans had trained the South Vietnamese boat crews and sabotage teams and overcome various equipment and mechanical difficulties. Operations in May and June were generally successful. The maritime force captured several North Vietnamese junks and destroyed a storage facility and a bridge near the North Vietnamese port of Hau Mon Dong. Covert maritime operations became associated with another form of pressuring the Hanoi government, destroyer patrols along the North Vietnamese coast. The Navy had been conducting these De Soto patrols sporadically since December 1962. Marine operations, or MAROPS, had increased MACV's requirements for current intelligence on the North Vietnamese coast, and after February 1964, the Navy assisted MACV in gathering photographic and electronic information for use in planning these covert operations. Probably in response to raids on their coastline, the North Vietnamese had reinforced their motor gunboat forces in the Gulf of Tonkin. On July 22nd, the Joint Chiefs authorized a July 31st De Soto patrol to assess North Vietnamese naval capability. Separately, on the night of July 30th to 31st, under orders from General Westmoreland, four of the MAROPS patrol boats departed Da Nang for targets on the islands of Han Mae and Han Nu in the Gulf of Tonkin. After shelling their targets from offshore, the boats returned with four wounded South Vietnamese sailors. At 3:40 p.m. Saigon time, on August 2nd, the SINCPAC, Admiral Sharp, sent a flash message to Admiral MacDonald and the Joint Chiefs. He reported that three torpedo boats had attacked the Navy destroyer Maddox in the Gulf of Tonkin. The Maddox returned fire. The torpedo boats, after receiving numerous hits and near misses, closed on the destroyer and because of the volume of fire, made an ineffective launch of two torpedoes. Soon, aircraft from the USS Ticonderoga joined in the engagement. The fire from the American planes and the Maddox damaged two of the vessels and left a third dead in the water. SINCPAC ordered the destroyer Turner Joy to join the Maddox, and the two ships continued patrolling 16 miles from the North Vietnamese coastline. The president, convinced that the attack was a response to Op-Plan 34 Alpha operations, decided to downplay the incident. Accordingly, the Pentagon issued a statement that did not mention North Vietnam. Later that evening, Rusk, in New York for a speaking engagement, trumpeted a familiar election year theme. When asked about the president's decision to forego retaliation, he observed that many incidents since 1945 could have led to another world war if sobriety had not exercised a restraining influence. Despite the president's desire to demonstrate restraint to the American people, he ordered the resumption of DeSoto patrols and the continuation of covert maritime operations to show the flag and convey to Hanoi that the United States did not intend to back down. After meeting with the president, General Wheeler cabled Admiral Sharp that the destroyers were authorized to continue DeSoto patrols no less than 11 miles from the coast. Wheeler ordered Sharp to take precautionary measures, such as providing air protection for the patrols in daylight hours and avoiding close approaches to the coast when maritime activities related to Op Plan 34A were underway. Taylor felt that the president's statement that the U.S. intended to continue patrolling the Gulf of Tonkin was insufficiently forceful. In a cable to Secretary Rusk, the ambassador argued that the absence of retaliatory measures would encourage future North Vietnamese attacks and give the South Vietnamese the impression that America flinches from direct confrontation. He recommended that the president consider the following actions. Announced that American forces would attack North Vietnamese patrol boats whenever they were found in international waters. Overfly North Vietnamese territory to accomplish regular air surveillance of North Vietnamese naval vessels. Mine approaches to the patrol boats' harbors and enhance the capability of the South Vietnamese Navy to hit targets in the north. In closing, Taylor pressured Rusk for immediate consideration of his recommendations so that he might inform the South Vietnamese government of U.S. intentions. Taylor's cable was not warmly received. On August 3rd, George Ball called McNamara to discuss it. Ball thought that Taylor's recommendations were extreme and amounted to a declaration of war. As an alternative, Ball recommended that Forrestal work with McNamara's staff in the International and Security Affairs Division to develop some announceable rules for engagement that would appear fierce. McNamara agreed that Taylor was overreacting and recommended that they simply ignore his cable rather than establish rules of engagement, which would be a little difficult to announce. He recommended instead that the president make a succinct statement indicating American willingness to attack and destroy any force that attacks us in international waters. After his conversation with Ball, McNamara telephoned the president, who took the advice of his most trusted advisor and called an impromptu press conference at the White House. Johnson told reporters that he had instructed the Navy to issue orders to the commanders of the combat aircraft and the two destroyers, A, to attack any force which attacks them in international waters, and B, to attack with the objective not only of driving off the force, but of destroying it. No matter how much presidential authority Taylor carried with him to Saigon, he could not overcome his absence from the center of decision-making. In Taylor's absence, McNamara gained influence with the president, in part by keeping the ambassador's recommendation away from Johnson's eyes. In place of Taylor's suggested statement, McNamara had Lyndon Johnson make a public declaration that would, in Ball's words, appear fierce. The president's statement was designed to placate Ambassador Taylor and members of Congress who favored direct retaliation for the Tonkin Gulf incident. McNamara thought it best that the president lie low. If pressure to take retaliatory action continued to mount, Johnson might consider revealing to the public some of the covert activities already underway against North Vietnam. Taylor, no longer under McNamara's direct influence, might have succumbed to local pressures in Vietnam and lost some of his sensitivity to political considerations in Washington. The change in Taylor's relationship with McNamara and Johnson was significant. In Washington, it had been easy for him to share their view of the situation in Vietnam and support their policy. When confronted with the reality of the situation in Vietnam, he revised his assessment of it. He then began to recommend actions that were not in accord with the president's electoral concerns. Rather than re-examine their view of conditions in Vietnam in light of the observations of a trusted member of their circle, McNamara and Johnson were so focused on the election and domestic priorities that they discarded Taylor's opinions and began to see him as a potential adversary rather than an ally. Rusk cabled Taylor that he, the president, McNamara, and McGeorge Bundy had been very sensitive to his recommendations and hoped that Johnson's statement had addressed some of his concerns. Perhaps to keep the ambassador from becoming discouraged, Rusk told Taylor that the ongoing 34 Alpha operations had begun to rattle Hanoi, and the Maddox incident is directly related to their effort to resist these activities. He vowed that we have no intention of yielding to pressure. He then made it clear that Taylor's prior recommendations were no longer open to discussion. At the end of the telegram, he stated plainly that he welcomed Taylor's comments only on the Saigon reaction to today's announcement and on the political temperature there. Although a letter he sent to Hanoi referred to the Gulf of Tonkin incident as an unprovoked attack, President Johnson knew that the American planned and supported raids on North Vietnamese territory had provoked the naval engagement. To minimize the likelihood of further incidents, Bundy recommended that future DeSoto patrols appear less directly connected with covert operations. General Wheeler briefed the president on plans for maritime operations against North Vietnam scheduled for that night. His briefing must have reassured the president and his advisors, for the meeting soon ended. Although the president opposed retaliation, he affirmed his commitment to continuing covert operations against North Vietnam. His decision was consistent with the central tenet of the evolving strategic concept for Vietnam: demonstrate restraint, yet appear steadfast and determined. Meanwhile, the Marine Operations, or MAROPS unit, was preparing for another raid on the coast of North Vietnam. After midnight on August 3rd, two PT boats in one of the many actions that Assistant Secretary of State William Bundy described as inherently small and unimportant poured 770 rounds of high-explosive munitions into the North Vietnamese radar facility near Vinh Son. Another boat illuminated and shelled a security post near the mouth of the Ron River, leaving it in flames. The president's decision to keep a low profile after the August 2nd incident proved short-lived. At 9 o'clock a.m. on August 4th, Robert McNamara received an urgent intelligence report based on North Vietnamese radio transmissions. The report warned that the Turner Joy and the Maddox, still on patrol off the coast of North Vietnam, might soon be subjected to another North Vietnamese attack. The possibility of a second incident aroused McNamara into a flurry of activity. After reading the message, he telephoned the president with the news that the Maddox was on the alert again, with the presence of hostile ships reported. Johnson asked McNamara how long it would take to conduct a bombing raid on North Vietnam. He then returned to the East Wing dining room to resume his weekly breakfast meeting with Democratic congressional leaders. No attack had yet been confirmed. The president recognized immediately the political desirability of retaliation should a second attack occur. After recounting his conversation with McNamara, he told the legislators that if there was another attack, the United States would have to retaliate. Johnson also communicated his hope that Congress would pass a resolution following retaliatory action to demonstrate the government's solidarity behind both the reprisal and his Vietnam policy in general. The legislators agreed that another incident would virtually require American military action against North Vietnam, and they supported the president's idea of a congressional resolution. Although Johnson's prompt consideration of the possibility of military reprisals may seem inconsistent with his holding strategy, he was willing to do so in order to win in November. His holding strategy was consistent with poll results showing that two-thirds of the American public paid little attention to the situation in Southeast Asia. A July 1964 poll conducted in Maryland indicated that voters cared little about foreign policy issues in general. As a front runner in the election, Johnson sought to stress consensus issues, stay vague on controversial issues, and contrast the opponent's extremism with his centrism. Virtually all Americans supported peace, and Johnson wanted to appear reluctant to order military action without first exhausting all other alternatives. His prudent image contrasted with Goldwater's hawkish stance on national security and military policy. The possibility of another attack in the Gulf of Tonkin, however, gave Johnson an opportunity for a political masterstroke against his chief political adversary. Political analyst John Bartlow Martin observed that Lyndon Johnson not only wanted to win the election, he wanted to win bigger than anybody had ever won. A one-time strike on North Vietnam would allow Johnson to continue as the candidate for peace while demonstrating that he was neither indecisive nor timid. After meeting with Democratic legislators, Johnson continued to discuss the possibility of retaliation with Kenneth O'Donnell, a White House assistant who had once been Kennedy's confidant. O'Donnell later recalled that he and Johnson agreed as politicians that his leadership was being tested and that he must respond decisively. He told Johnson that the president must not allow Goldwater to accuse him of vacillating or being an indecisive leader. O'Donnell's advice resonated with counsel Johnson had received 5 months earlier from his trusted friend and mentor, Senator Richard Russell. In February, Johnson had telephoned the senator to seek advice on Castro's decision to cut off water supplies to the American naval base at Guantanamo Bay. Russell warned Johnson that there was a slowly increasing feeling in the country that we're not being as harsh and firm in our foreign relations as we should be. That is, we're worried more about our image than our substance. Although Russell believed that people did not trust Goldwater's judgment, he warned the president that any demagogue with any strength could threaten the president's chances for re-election. On the morning of August 4th, Johnson was presented with an opportunity to preempt that possibility. Aware that Johnson wished to retaliate should the North attack the patrolling vessels, McNamara took charge of formulating policy options. While Wheeler hurried back to Washington from New York, McNamara hastily convened an ad hoc planning group, including Vance, Lieutenant General Birkenall, and other members of the Joint Staff. McNamara instructed Birkenall to act as liaison between the Secretary of Defense and Admiral Sharp, SINCPAC. He wanted to know how quickly Sharp could mount a retaliatory strike on North Vietnam. Birkenall told McNamara that the aircraft carrier Ticonderoga, which was operating near the North Vietnamese coast, could hit any target north of the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, by 6 o'clock p.m. Washington time or 6 o'clock a.m. Saigon time. After conferring for less than 30 minutes, McNamara received flash reports that the North Vietnamese torpedo boats had again attacked the American destroyers. He immediately told Johnson, who replied, "They have? Now I'll tell you what I want. I not only want those patrol boats that attacked the Maddox destroyed, I want everything at that harbor destroyed. I want the whole works destroyed. I want to give them a real dose." McNamara told Johnson that a retaliatory strike could be ready before 6 o'clock p.m. Shortly thereafter, the White House press office informed the major networks that in time for the 7 o'clock news, the president would appear before the American people to issue a statement of major importance about Vietnam. At the Pentagon, naval officers familiar with carrier operations shook their heads in disbelief. Aircraft on the Ticonderoga were outfitted with weaponry for air-to-air or air-to-ship combat, It would take hours to reconfigure the aircraft for bombing and longer to brief pilots on their assigned targets. Although no officer challenged Birkenau's assessment